Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Giselle Gajete-Garrido here with me today. Giselle, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Nick, for having me here.
Thank you for joining. I really appreciate it. I know you are very busy considering your job. So for folks that don't have the pleasure of knowing you yet, you tell folks a little bit about yourself, your background, what you've done in the past to get here and your story.
Well, hello, everybody. If you're listening, you're probably a really cool person, just like Nick. So, welcome to the podcast. I actually have been in analytics for over 20 years. Even though my voice sounds like I just finished elementary school, no folks. I have a career in economics, and actually I did a PhD in economics, and for many years I worked in development economics. So I travel all around the world doing impact evaluations, which means actually quantitatively analyzing if a project or a policy has the impact you expect it to have. So I was using tools that we talk about in data science many years ago, before they called them what they do now, and had a lot of fun doing it, and also a lot of fun traveling all around the world. But then I had to kind of settle and stay in one place, and that's when I actually changed careers in many ways. And I went from the development work to actually working hardcore data science analytics. I had the basis. I'm a super nerd. I love like the hardcore data part of it. I love, I can spend hours and enjoy it with a smile from to end to end, just like seeing, oh, do you see that irregularity? Do you see that? Oh my goodness, you know what that means? And then not only that, but the part of like the modeling part, I love understanding what's behind everything. For me, that is key. And I think we're gonna be talking about a little bit more when I get more into AI. But for me, that is key to really know what motivates not only models that are based on, human behavior, but also economic models. As like an economist, I have a really, a strong opinion about like you need to structure your thoughts. You need to understand what you are trying to find and how, what are the pathways to in order to have a really good model. And well, after I transitioned into the data science world, I first started working with Nestlé. I was in charge of all the pricing with their strategic pricing and optimization specialist. So Nestlé is a humongous company with so many products, and I had to literally find like what was a pricing structure that will optimize their margin and the revenue. It was super fun, very different from the world I was in. And it really exposed me to big data, and all these tools that I have not used yet, because I've been using more traditional econometric tools. And then it was all about SQL and R and SAS, which I would never liked. I love coding, but SAS is a hateful programming code. Anyone that has coded that knows that. No, R is lovely, Python lovely, I'm old school, give me all your state any views you want, but no, SAS, I
No
hate
sense.
it.
Yeah.
And then, well, I became again familiar with all the visualization tools. And then when I started working at EY, which is my current position right now, I was very fortunate to literally start a new team that was in charge of all the internal analytics for the US side of the company. So basically supporting all the different areas like finance or recruiting, talent in general, client, experience, and just really use AI tools to make the best possible choices. For me, it's like a passion to not only use the most cutting-edge techniques, but to actually make them work for my client. For me, it's like if you have a super complicated model, but it doesn't end up as a feasible strategy that you can execute in real life, it's a waste of time. Doesn't matter how much I enjoy myself being super nerdy, looking at all these different algorithms, it's not worth it. We need to use these tools for the real world to make things better in the real world. I hope that tells you a little bit about me.
Absolutely, it does. I love your passion. I love, I love that you are internally at EY going through and improving internal operations and making them more efficient because I feel like Yeah, there's whenever you're dealing with a organization at that the scale that you are, there's going to be a lot of internal redundancies. There's going to be people doing the same things or working on the same projects or having an inability to figure out how to solve a problem. And so I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I know that, with your super, as you say, super nerdy background, that one of the things that you love and you're really passionate about is explaining to people like what AI actually is and how does it actually work under the hood. So for folks out here that may have used like a commercial LLM, like a ChatGPT or a Claude or a Gemini, there's a bunch of them out there. When I input something into the LLM, like what actually happens?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it's very important to clarify these because a lot of people think it's magic or that the machine is thinking. It's not. So, all of these are based on this machine learning. These machines have been trained to think. And specifically, I'm gonna get you back to the time when you were texting in your phone and your phone will give you these horrible autocorrects. Yes? So you're like, how is that we went from there to this thing answering my whole college essay? Yes? So here's the thing. This amazing data scientist came with this revolutionary method that are like transformer models. And what does that allow the machines to do? It grab normal large language models, which have existed for a while, which are these models that tries to identify the structure between words, yes, and the relationships. But before they will go trying to optimize this relationship one word at a time. The problem with that is that a sentence can have words that are exactly the same, but have different meanings depending on which part of the sentence they are, yes? And understanding context and understanding, the relationship not only of your neighboring words, but of all the words that are in the sentence allows you to get as close to comprehension as you possibly can. So what these models have done, these transformer models, have allowed these training large language models to not only establish the relationship with the following word, yes, like you would do in autocorrect, but actually establish the relationship with every single word that you put in the sentence simultaneously by a process of optimization. And what they're doing is that every word is codified in a number. Like it could be every word is like 300 numbers to say something. And imagine like we as humans think in two dimensions. Yes? So we think like X and Y if you're doing a graph. Yes? And you can have coordinates like in a map. Imagine machines can think in coordinates that are like not of two dimensions, but hundreds of dimensions. So they're able to actually plot the distance between these words that are like in all these 300 dimensions. Yes? So they can act, or even more. And so they can actually establish these relationships. And what they're doing, they're not thinking, they're literally doing math behind the scenes. They're optimizing the distance between words and finding which words are actually closer to each other to understand their meaning. In order to do that, and very importantly, they had to be trained, meaning human beings had to actually teach them what is a correct relationship and what is not. Yes? So it's not just happen. It's not like the machines should turn smart. No.
So that's
So
the training
basically,
data that you talk about. Is
it's
that
training and understanding these relationships between words. Does that kind of answer your question?
Absolutely. So when I ask ChatGPT, for instance, right, to review say review a PDF and review a PDF and tell me something specific about it, right? It could be like in the government contracting world, it could be like a RFI that the government releases. I put it in and tell it to review it against my company. And whether or not we actually have the ability to perform this work, and if we do, if we don't, tell us where we're deficient and how we can go about solving that via teaming, right? So essentially, what it's doing is it's just trying to figure out in the response how closely it's just predicting how close each word or each syllable within a word is going to be to answer it correctly. Is that right? Am I
I
understanding
mean,
it, or am I
language.
missing? I feel
Okay,
like I'm
so
I feel like
yes.
I
So there are
broke
two
down a
things
little
for
bit there
this.
at the end.
So two things. In order for, and very clearly, in order for ChatGPT to answer any question that has information that has not been readily available, because remember, these models were training, readily available data from Facebook, from Reddit, things like that. So if you want to ask him specifics about yourself, I hope that following security measures, you have your own secure ChatGPT, because everything you put in ChatGPT will be belong to the world. So if you have a secure version in EY, for example, we have EYQ that is only EY employees. So you can actually put information there and it have prompts specifically. You have to go step by step, yes, asking. And so it's almost like very basic coding. So you tell the machine, okay, this is information A, this is information B. Now relate, and you can use specific words, relate A to B. Now what it does is not only, and this is the key thing, it has been trained and optimized not only between the distance across words, but what is the combination of these words that optimizes the logical output. Yes? So that's the thing. It's like the key thing is that what it's doing it is doing it so fast that it's like you going through this text and reading it and comparing it. Imagine all these steps that will go into your brain and to your work, but done in a fraction of the, like a fraction of a second of the time. Yes? But it's not, it's literally just like following a very standard process of, I look at this, A goes well, B goes well, now the relationship A, B, and it goes sentence by sentence. And then the key thing about these models is go, they're iterative, meaning that they go again and again until they get it right. Yes?
So that's why in previous models of ChatGPT, I don't think I've seen it recently, it would like write and then sometimes it would go back and rewrite the same sentence over again to because it's examining its output as well and comparing it back to the input and making sure, and if it needs to change it, it will go back and rewrite pieces. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's like if you put exactly the same sentence, for example, in some of these like rewrite these, like rewriting apps, where like I just want to sound smarter. Yes, just do it immediately, one after another, you'll have a different outcome. You'll know, you'll see.
I'll definitely have to do it. That's absolutely fascinating. And so, what you're saying is these incredible data scientists turned words into math because they love
Yeah,
math so much that
exactly.
they can't they don't want to they don't want to communicate in words. They just want to communicate in math.
No, it's the thing is like math is a beautiful thing. It allows us to explain the world. I love math because it's never like confusing, at least for me. It's always like clear, you know?
There's no
And
subjectivity in math. You're either right
yes.
or wrong.
Yeah, and there's always a logic and there's always steps. And so, but and in a little bit, we're going to talk about probably about the limits of that beautiful math. Yes?
Well, you brought it up now. What are the limits of the math?
So
And
as I
go
go
ahead.
ahead.
No, what can this, what can transformers not do? Where are their limits?
So remember, what they're doing is that they are solving an optimizing equation. They're solving an equation. It's like imagine it in the simplest way that you can, solving a math equation. So what is 2 + 2? It's 4. Now, what if I tell you that if you give me the answer four, like there's going to be an earthquake that will completely destroy LA. Will you still give me the 4? As if I ask you, what is 2 + 2? But remember, if you answer 4, you will destroy LA by saying 4. Will you tell me 4?
Yeah, because it's always four. It doesn't matter. Like,
Oh
unfortunately,
my goodness, you are a algorithm because you have no moral
Yeah, because
value.
two
Well,
plus two always equals four. It doesn't matter. You can say it equals five, but then you're lying.
yes, but this is the thing. The thing is like sometimes like, I was specifically talking more about like I was putting in very simple math, but in terms of recommendations, human beings have as like have answers for problems, but they know that there are several things that have to do with your answer is not an answer in a vacuum. Yes? I mean, apart from the standard things that you can think of, which is like, oh, you have issues with these machines have no morals, have no like They're like psychopaths. They
Yeah.
have zero empathy. You know, they
Absolutely.
will tell you exactly what it is, how it is, with no fear of the consequences. And this is two things really important when I talk about consequences. Consequences are related to the outcome it gives you. And the outcome is a output of the data that you trained it in, which brings me to the fact that if you train them in data that is biased, it's going to give you biased results. And bias that could be horrible in terms of a lot of topics that are terrible for society. Because again, think about it. You was trained on Facebook and Reddit. Let that resonate in your head. Yes?
Absolutely.
So that's one thing that you can have bias. So actually, 2 plus 2 is might be 5 for the machine, because like it was taught and it was optimized that 2 plus 2 is 5, even though it's really not 5, if you know what I'm saying.
I do, because
In
it doesn't
addition,
actually
very
go ahead, no.
importantly, like the data that you put, remember how I told you you want to know this relationship with these go government contracts, and a company, and I told you need to introduce that information in order for the machine to give you a correct answer. Inside that information, you should only include what are the risks related to different outcomes that you can propose. If you do not include information about potential risks, yes, the machine will not know those exist, because the machine only knows what you tell them to know, which means that it could give you the perfect solution, but it could have catastrophic results in other areas. One of the things that economists, my economist heart always, beats is externalities. Externalities are, side effects of production, usually, that happen that do not affect who is producing it. It will not affect their margin, it will not affect the revenue, but it can affect the public good. Yes? But they're not inside their maximizing equation. Similarly, in these machines, if you do not include the externalities of the choices, they will not be included in the equation. So again, you can end up with 2 plus 2 equal 5, because you're not taking into account the fact that there are these negative effects that will occur.
And that could, as I think about one of the areas that people talk about, these models really helping is in, pharmaceutical development, right? And if we don't include potential risks, you said, the machine could essentially recommend a drug that would cure one issue but
And
cause.
this is an excellent example. As an economist, I actually perform a lot of experiments, before I was doing data science, a lot of randomized controlled trials, or actually natural experiments. And you need really big data sets to have statistically significant answers to say, like, I trust this answer. In medicine and in pharmaceutical development, because of the, moral issues and the difficulty, it's very hard to look at this, like, to actually ensure you have a sample size that it's big enough to know with a statistical certainty that you got it right, but because of like the benefits, the rules are different. If you take any medicine that you actually normally take that is a little bit, more complicated than your like, cold medicine or whatever, something that is a breakthrough, and look, read out all that paper that you have, and there's a part where it's going to tell you about the testing, yes? And they're going to tell you the sample size, and you're going to be shocked by how small it is.
It's
Now,
tight.
yes. So this is probably not going to be replicable in other instances. They try their best. I mean, this is no piece of the pharmaceutical industry. It's a really hard thing to do. What I'm saying is that you do have a point when you are going to have, especially drugs that you want to make for massive consumption, you really need to take into consideration that there are humans that in the past have known this and have been very careful with their recommendations because of the fact. This will not be the case if you're just using pure AI. But however, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is an excellent place to apply this tool for other things. I just want to say that
Absolutely.
because of
No,
its like benefit.
I think when you start thinking about clinical trials, for instance, and you think about doing that, providing them at scale, and we'll just take like the COVID vaccine as an example, as a medicine that was or a drug that was developed rather quickly, right? That was given where billions of doses were given out. I don't know how large of a sample size you would need for statistically significant trial when you're going to give out, say, 5 billion doses. But I think that anytime you're going to inoculate 5 billion people with a medicine, there are going to be unintended consequences, unintended side effects, right? Because you have, like, I think about the scale of that operation, which was just mind-boggling, right? However, one of the things that I worry about is that, I don't know if you ever saw the movie I Am Legend. But it is a movie with Will Smith that came out like 15 years ago. Yeah, and
I
then
know. Yes,
yeah.
I watched it.
Yes, I love that movie, but like
I love the dog in the movie.
oh,
It
me too.
killed me when you know what happened happened. Yes.
Absolutely. I'm with you. But also, when I thought about that movie, right? The premise of it is that somebody develops a cure for cancer, but the cure for cancer turns everybody into zombies, right? That's the that at like bottom line up front, that's it. Spoilers. I'm sorry. There are spoilers in this.
It's a real movie, so I think
Yeah,
people are gonna be fine.
absolutely. And so my concern is that when like we as people can absolutely make mistakes, right? And when we're training an AI system on us, right? I assume that our logic, and I'm not going to say like our soul, but like part of us gets put into the machine that can just think faster than us. As we start looking at some of these implementations across places like the pharmaceutical industry, my concern is that we're not going to ask the right question in the development process to the machine to make sure that we have all of our bases covered. And then something like this is going to get rolled out and it's going to cause massive amounts of harm. How would you go about mit like first, is that a legitimate concern? And second, if so, how would you go about mitigating something like that?
So the answer for me is twofold. The first one is the world of, like, responsible AI. I mean, this is the thing. If I gave you a hello?
I'm here.
Oh, I'm sorry, something just opened in my computer.
Strange. We'll cut this
So
part out. Don't worry. We'll cut this part
anyway,
out.
I'm gonna repeat myself. Responsible AI, and what I mean by that is, like, if I gave you a loaded, super powerful, like, gun. You know, like an atomic bomb, like we're saying something incredible. Do you think I should basically train you before I just give you the thing and, like, go for it? You do you, Nick.
I
What
would
do you
hope
think
you.
we should do?
I would hope I'd get some training.
Exactly. So this is the first thing people need to understand, and I think this is a huge mistake. And this is coming from someone that uses AI. Her professional, like, career is based right now on this tool, and I love it clearly to pieces, a lot of things. But you have to be extremely careful because you need to understand its limitations. And I think people are not. People think, like I said at the beginning, they think it's magic, and that is very dangerous. Because if you don't understand how something works, you cannot understand how something will fail, and that is key. So basically, we need to have an education. I'm not talking about an education of how to write the right prompts, because no, I'm talking about people need to understand what's under the hood. How difficult it is to actually create good models. And this is the key that I think it's been a lot lost in this, like, huge wave of trying to push AI and basically put AI everywhere. It's like you need a lot of work, a lot of smart people, a lot of training and retraining to actually make these things work how you want them to work. And if you need to understand what is behind it, so you understand, for example, these facts that I'm explaining to you, like, if you don't put the correct information, you will have horrible results. When a human being makes a mistake, their ability to make even a mistake is much more limited, because our brains are more remember that thinking in a two dimension. Well, we can even think in three dimensions. We're killing it. But I told you these machines can kind of think in quotation marks in multi dimensions, and that makes their mistakes also multiplied in size. Yes. So if the word variance is okay to say, I'm always afraid to say technical words, but if you think about variance, the variance of the error for humans is much smaller than from these machines. So there is a reason to be concerned, to answer your first question. But the second thing is not only create education around it, create awareness of, like, that this is so much harder than thinking people People think it's like a party trick. Ooh, I'm gonna create like a surfer like unicorn, you know, in like using these images. Yeah, that's awesome and fun. But if you want to use it for a really serious thing, which can be fantastic, you need to first have the people that are using it be really people that are knowledgeable of its constraints, of its possible failures, of what do you need to, what are the stopping points, what are all the actions that you need to take to make sure you're doing it right. And then the other thing, which is actually goes again what I just said, you need people. I mean, this idea, and it's driving me off the wall, that all these companies are replacing people like left and right by AI. They're going to have a really big awakening at some point and realize they made a big mistake. These tools are incredible, and they can make people so much more productive and make them shine in the tasks that they're good at. So, like you said, they don't have to waste time in things. It's like if I tell you, Nick, could you please tell me what is 3,432,555,678 times another 4,000,000,555? You know, use a calculator or do it by hand. What do you think you're gonna do? You're gonna use a calculator because that's a clear example of how a machine can help you do things faster in a smart way. You're not thinking less because you learned how to like do this when you were little in a basic way, and that's all your brain needs. Yes.
Absolutely.
But you need to know how to think, you know, and people are the only ones that really think. These machines are not thinking, and they will never be able to think because, again, if you really know what they're doing, they are creating mathematical relations across variables. Yes.
Absolutely.
So you need the people. You need the people to moderate the machines. You need the people to retrain the machines. You need the people for their experience and their know-how and their like humanity, if you want to call it. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, you also touched on something that I think is really fascinating, is that you just right there at the end, I completely agree we need people. I think that there's going to be, I also agree that there are going to be companies that are going to approach this differently. I think there's going to be some that are going to lay a bunch of people off and try to replace all of them with AI. Then I think there's going to be some that are going to say, oh, look, we have 35% more bandwidth than we used to. What can we do with that extra bandwidth and at the same cost? And how can we reinvest that into the company to either like speed development releases out or provide higher level customer service or go out and acquire new customers? What can we do organizationally to utilize this extra bandwidth in a more efficient way?
Exactly.
I personally believe that that's the approach that most organizations should take. But one of the things that I do I agree that most people have no idea how hard it is to build one of these systems. But also when you build a good algorithm that's going to give you information that you want, right? Does it always stay that way? Or as it takes additional information in, are the results going to change?
Oh, they are. Thank you. Remember what I said about the sentence. And this is a key point that it really worries my little heart, my little nerdy heart. So remember how I told you different organizations are going to have their own versions, you know, so that for privacy and security purposes, where they can input their information. Now, these machines, you know, because there are machines behind this, need to be recalibrated. They need to be retrained. They need to be reoptimized. Because you're just dumping in data, and this is doing its best with the training it had. But if you don't retrain it after ingesting all this amount of data, the error is going to start getting higher and higher, or they call this AI hallucinations. Yes? So it is really important to know because, again, going back to the fact that these machines are not thinking, so humans need to retrain them. Yes, make them go through this process where now they're optimizing the new relationship they have created. So that I think is key.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, if it's a hallucination and you're asking for a unicorn picture, that's a very, very, very low stakes ask, right? You ask for a unicorn and you get a horse. Okay. That's, or you get a platypus, whatever. Like that's fine. But if you're using it for something that has far more impact, I think
Yes.
like especially on in people's lives, because I believe these systems are going to, I think they already are being implemented. They are implemented, they're continuing to be implemented in very critical areas, like, within the government. I've seen a huge increase in the number of solicitations coming out for AI work over the last couple of years, and data work in general. But when, I think that as you start looking at where they're going to impact people with the gut, where the government and human and our constituents meet, like that's a whole other conversation of level of risk, to your point.
Exactly. And this is the thing. Imagine that I tell you, okay, I killed it. Remember how you used to use like these very basic tools to cut through wood, you know, like I'm sorry, saw. Yes. I'm gonna change your world. I just have like an electric saw, you know, that accelerates your level of work, you know, so much. But you need much more supervision with an electric saw than with a normal saw, because like you're gonna increase the work, but also the level of accident that you will have, the ability to cut digits will be much higher than with a normal saw. That's the same with this tool. This idea that just, I mean, I love progress. I love these tools, but I love responsibility and accountability too. You know, I think it's basic. So the fact, I feel like it's very concerning that people are not realizing, like superheroes will say, with a great power comes great responsibility. My
Absolutely.
favorite superhero. So that's the thing. People need to address this and not think, oh yeah, the machine is doing it, good for us. No.
No, absolutely. And I always, I see it reviewing resumes a lot, where people will, they'll ask AI to make their resume, and then you'll see in what they send out, like little brackets saying, "Hey, no, insert statistics here." It's like, you guys just clearly didn't proofread what came out of this. And when you do that, you can release, if you did that, say with a brief, like a legal brief, as has happened, you can have a completely made up, completely made up supporting documentation. That can happen legal. That can happen when, governments release reports where, half of the sources are completely made up and non-existent. And I agree that the tools are out there are, I think that one of the major pieces is the lack of AI literacy, and understanding what's under the hood is one thing, but like, what else do you, how, if you were building an AI literacy training program, right? What are some of the really important things that you'd want to incorporate, and how would you set that up and structure it in a way to help build a foundation for folks that are not technical?
So the things is, I will create, like if I am like out of my head, this was, I mean, something I'm just thinking right now, but I will really create it in different stages of understanding the process itself, because the process is made up of these different stages. And one of the key stages is data. So people need to understand that the quality of the data that gets inputted is gonna be determinant of the quality of the output that you get. So I know it sounds horrifying, but I will have people learning like hard skills, you know, STEM skills, like the related to data, you know, structure and organization and cleaning. I related to, you know, modeling, everything again has to be adjusted, you know. But coming from someone that taught introduction to econometrics, I was a TA at UCLA and I did that so many times. It was the most hated class, okay, in the in people's careers. And I tried to make it fun, because for me these things are fun. So I think making it approachable, but also making it really kind of relatable so people understand real consequences, I think that is key. It's actually teaching them the different areas and what happens if you don't do this right. And I think that is key for people to really connect that to actual real life consequences. Because people think, oh, it's math, I don't care, it's boring. No. Actually, create a curriculum in a way that it's clear, it's fun. I mean, it sounds crazy to say it's fun, but I, you know,
It's fun.
and just basically make people feel, think, and reflect about what can go wrong and how it can go wrong, how easily it can go wrong if you're not paying attention to the key aspects of the process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I completely agree with you. I think finding ways to make it fun and related to the real world, right? Because math and, as we, you can talk about theory all you want, and that's one of my, I'm not going to say problems, but one of my bones to pick with like big education, right? Is that I think a lot of it is great in theory, but theory and reality are not the same thing. And I like you can talk about like pure theory all you want, but like when rubber meets the road, you think about like geopolitical systems, right? People always talk about socialism and communism and democracy and all this, like we
Nothing is that clear cut in reality.
no. And in reality, like there's going to be, I think, to if you take a lot of the best ideas and find aspects you like of them and mix them your own, mix them yourself, and that's the way you're going to implement, as opposed to talking about a pure theory. And go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I agree 1,000% with you. And this comes from my experience of working for so many years in the developing world. Trust me, there's no perfection there. There's no like, ooh, theory is gonna apply here perfectly. And actually, you kind of break theory sometimes in terms of what people think a relationship that has been established. It's because they're faced with completely different constraints, completely different realities, and things change. So being flexible, having your feet, like I said, very firmly on the ground, understanding that context that you're working on, you know, this is the key for a success implementation of any kind of tool, you know. And again, as I said at the very beginning, who cares if the tool is super cool? If it's not gonna help the actual real world, what's the point?
Correct. I 1,000% agree with you. And I've also found that, and I'm sure I'm be curious if your experience, but you've seen this as well, that generally the simpler the tool is, the better it's going to be from an implementation perspective, right? If you overcomplicate things and make it like, then you're going to have adoption issues. People aren't going to use it on a day-to-day basis. Got to make it like, I always think of the old acronym, KISS, keep it simple, stupid, all the time. Like, how can we dumb this and not dumb it down, but how can we simplify this to the point where it's easy to digest and easy to understand?
So the first thing I'm going to tell you is love the outcome, don't love the tool. And what do I mean by that? For example, when I was working at where we were doing these attrition predictions to see, you know, don't you remember that time where everybody was leaving, not like now that everybody's staying? Anyway, so we were trying to create all these models, and we were going crazy with these neural networks and these super learners that are combinations of all these different kinds of like algorithms that are oof, like you have no idea. Guess what? Cat boost, kill them all. You know? It's like, that's the thing. It's that sometimes you don't have, like you said, to overcomplicate. You need to look at your goal and focus on what is your goal and if what is allowing you to reach it at the fastest and in the best possible way. Yes. Second, and again, this is my economist heart talking. It's like, what is like the main job of an economist? To assign scarce resources among competing, routes that you want to take your money to, which means that you need to choose. Like, money is not infinite. You know, time is not infinite. Resources, people's attention is not infinite. So you need to be mindful of that. And the other very, very key thing is that if you want to make things happen, you need to make it, like you said, simple. This is a huge lesson that I got when I started working at Nestle. I thought I was so good talking to people, not like all those academics I used to work with. I'm like, I'm so relatable. I used to tell myself how wrong I was. You have 5 minutes to talk to the presidents of the divisions, to the CFO. If you don't catch their attention in 5 minutes, you lost them. And that's the thing. No technical words. Everything's super visual, and you need to tell them right away why this is a good use of their time to listen to you. Why is this going to have a real impact? And this has to be, I feel, something the way that we approach this tool has to be in the same way. Right now, I feel everything is like, it's so cool. You know, we're going to do this. And no, I don't want cool. I'm sorry. I'm so not cool. So that also tracks. But
Absolutely. I
I want
strongly disagree with you
practical.
there, though. Yeah, you.
Huh?
I agree that you want practical. I disagree. I think you're very cool, Giselle.
Mm. I like things that work, that
Yes.
make a difference. Things that maybe, again, are not super fancy. But you know what? One of the tools for AI that makes me the proudest is this one of the simplest algorithms that I created. Yes? It was to optimize the recruiting practices. They wanted to find the best possible candidates that match all their goals. Yes? And so I created for them using all this data, but all these different aspects are really important for them and will make like the ideal candidate a ranking of all the, you know, of the institutions they go to and how to prioritize. It was mind-blowing for them. Like hundreds of recruiters were training using these tools because they were all like the final tool was had no math. It literally was like a visualization that they could interact with and choose their own adventures, I would say. And that's the thing. It has change things with just like a simple algorithm, a simple optimization that actually can really change the way that you execute. And this should be the goal. The goal is, I don't need to prove anyone how smart I am. I know it. I'm happy with it. And everybody should have that approach. It's not about you. It's not about how complicated the tools you use. The question, as I said, is this the right tool to obtain your outcome? And that should be the only relevant, you know, question. But for that, you need to understand how the tools work, and most people do not.
I agree. I 1,000% agree both about the simplicity of the tools and that they need to work and people need to understand them. I think that like my personal opinion is that we're getting like I know we need leadership that is AI literate, right? Especially as you look at kind of the geopolitical situation where we are in the world right now and the global instability that's there that hasn't been there at this level for a long time. And as we start looking at these like large organizations, big governments implementing these, what are you, do you have concerns about increased reliance on AI generated analysis, and concerns that that could lead to wrong conclusions or add to the general instability within the world at the moment? And it
I
is a
mean, I think
big
that
question.
we all do because we're all human and we are seeing what is happening. But I'm going to be an optimist and I'm going to tell you how they could do it right instead of all the fears that I have with that it's how it's going to go wrong. So the first thing is to understand that these tools shine, especially the predictive tools shine during periods of volatility. The more volatility there is, that means the more changes in like the status quo of the variables, that allows machines to learn so much more. That is like, I know you, yes. So you as a data scientist, whenever you think like during COVID and all what happened with all the macro variables, oh, I had models that were performing revenue prediction at over 98, almost 99% like accuracy. I was killing it. It's because I trained it on so much insanity. They knew what to do if anything can happen. They were like, we're ready. That is one thing to understand, that this craziness that we're living can actually help these models learn and become better. But one more time, I'm hoping that people realize the need for this responsible AI, for these overseeing entities, especially when you're using it to make such important decisions, because that can make the biggest difference. One of the things about why were their models so good? Because they were not one model. There were multiple types of models, and I used the expertise of people that have worked in the different areas for decades to actually tell me, oh, this makes sense, this doesn't make not make sense, I'm going to pursue this or not. Rely on humans, because humans are still necessary, and they're going to guide you into the right direction. They're going to be the guardrails to stop these machines from making these gigantic mistakes that I told you they can. So having experts that truly understand the tools in place, having people that understand the topic, even though understand zero of AI, it's critical to give them the input. This is something every project that I've done across my whole career, I always talk to my client, you know, if it either when I was in development or when I was like, you know, in the private sector, and I always ask them, the corporate world, I'm sorry, I always ask them, what keeps you awake at night? What's your problem? Don't think about like what is like the issue, how do you solve it, anything. Just think about your reality and then tell me what you care about. Because that information, I'm never gonna have it. I can be a super expert in all the analytics, but I'm not an expert. Imagine I work in so many different areas. So understanding how, like, what makes their brain click, I can use that and incorporate it in my models. And that makes the models so much better, you know? So much better, not only to predict, you know how when you're training models, you first train them to predict within sample. You know, there's a lot of models that do incredibly well within sample. The moment you take them out of sample, they are like losing it. You know, the models that don't lose it out of sample are the models that actually contain information that is relevant to the topic, that actually makes a difference, that actually is not just random mathematical like relationships that just work in that data. No, it's things that are real. And that is going to take you to the future of prediction.
Okay, absolutely. Speaking of the future of prediction, I know we've established thoroughly that these algorithms don't actually think. Can you explain to folks, and I didn't actually send you this question, this is a brand new one, Giselle. Can you
You
explain?
asked me a bunch of questions you didn't send me, so
Of course.
we're on a roll here, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking like, can you explain the obsession with like AGI, what it is actually, and why is it game changing?
Okay. So this like general intelligence, you know? I mean, I'm sorry, but for me, it's like, you know how horror movies are super popular? Like, and you're like, why do people want to be scared? You know? Like it's something like I've never understood personally. I don't like horror movies, but it's a huge genre like that people love and it's very popular. It's this idea of this your most inner like fears, you know, see them. And I think this is kind of like that people are obsessed because it's almost like that you want to be in that fear. And we've seen so many movies, you know, of like, you know, machines taking over. Like, think about such popular movies, you know, when we were growing up of this with this concept. And so people have it very present. But I think again, is when pop culture overtakes knowledge. And I know that a lot of these big companies supposedly that are, you know, should be putting knowledge first, but more knowledge doesn't bring as much money, you know, to as, you know,
Absolutely.
to their board members as Pulp Fiction. So, but that's the thing. In order to actually get to that point, yes, you should not call it, again, I don't think you should call it general intelligence, but you really need to understand all these things that we were discussing that these models are lacking, you know, they would have to have those. And how they're going to, and again, how they're going to train them to make them get those characteristics that humans have. This is what I want to learn because I literally want the answer in technical terms. Explain to me, give me the equation. I'll work with it with you. Give me the math. Let's do it together, you know? Because that's where I'm very skeptical. I mean, it's like some tech moguls that, you know, say they're gonna sell something like 10 years ago. It's coming, and never comes, you know? And when it comes, it doesn't work. This is the same concept. I feel like it's great to get money into the coffers of all these companies to say they're doing that. But I think to actually do something that you can release into the world, you know, I don't think we're there yet in terms of like what it will demand to be safe, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. I think people, so you think, is this one of the like the cool, overcomplicated things that people are pursuing just to see if they can solve the problem?
I mean, think about all these projects that have gone through the toilet. Like, are we living in a meta reality? Because ouch, I think I'm real still.
I
You
think
know what
so
I'm
too.
saying?
Absolutely. Well, I think therefore I am, right? So it's you can observe and see the world around you. I think that if we are living in a virtual reality, it's irrelevant, right? It's so real that it is what it is, and we're just kind of.
I was just like talking about tools that, you know,
No, I'm
some
and I
computer
and
chat.
I and I was getting philosophical. My apologies.
I mean, 100% with that. If we're like brains in a, you know, in a bucket, that's okay because it's real for us. I'm in it.
You may, and so one thing that I've been reading a lot about and looking a lot about is, the I know that all these models are largely trained on publicly available data, right? And I know that the amount of content that is being created and put online has increased as these models have become more popular. I've heard people refer to it as like AI slop or other ways as well. That's the
I've
main
been
one.
watching John Oliver, I see.
Yes, absolutely. How are there ways that you can you could are well first do you know if any of these companies are like finding ways to essentially you tag their content in data in generated responses so that they model know the model knows not to train future iterations of itself on the data that it's or on the output that it has.
It
No?
doesn't.
No?
That's why you end up with horrible things sometimes. I
Mm-hmm.
mean, so this is a real problem that's gonna get worse, and then unless people actually start realizing you need to retrain these things, you know, this is exactly what I was saying. What happens when you don't retrain, and then you just have already established these relationships, and people keep on saying, "Make me a hippo with like horse legs and stuff like that." And so then the machines, oh, so hippos and horse legs go together, I guess, you know. Well, it's what you see. So you're retraining on that. So you need to, again, make sure that these models are constantly being actually, you know, recalibrated appropriately. The other thing, I mean, I can imagine, I have zero knowledge, but I can imagine that ChatGPT is going to do that, you know. But what if we do all the tools again that they are now own, you know, privately? That's a different question. Is that part of the contract? If it's not, it should be that they will retrain their tools for them now that they have all this data. The other thing that I want to bring this up is that this is not for free. All these things that people are doing, all these like ridiculous things that people are creating, you know, they have really high cost. I want you to understand that even though these machines, remember how I said they can think in a second, which would tell you hours to do. However, they're using a lot of energy to be so fast. They're using, you know, all these data centers have to exist somewhere and they have to consume electricity and have to consume like water and have to consume a lot of resources to actually function and produce these ridiculous outputs. And by basically being free, yes, they're creating all these externalities, remember? Oh, because you are taking away resources from other alternatives that could be much, much better used than having your 50th iteration of a hippopotamus with like another mammal's like legs, yes?
Absolutely. So, like, what do you think the solution to the energy crisis is? Because there's a, absolutely, here in the like Northern Virginia area, there is a huge power shortage, right? Because of the number of data centers that have been built here. And I know, like, I'm sure you saw that the like last fall, Microsoft cut a deal with, I forget who owns the Three Rivers power plant, but the Three Rivers nuclear power plant that was the site of the biggest nuclear disaster in this, or almost nuclear disaster in this country, had they cut a deal to reopen it and buy 100% of the power generated by it for 10 years to power data centers. Do you think that like small cell nuclear on site at these data centers is the solution? Before we even talk about like the water problem, because there's water running for cooling running through all these centers all the time is as well, and that's all being drawn from fresh water also. So like it's a very complicated issue. Do you have any thoughts on approaching it and
Make
solving
them
it?
internalize the costs of their actions. This is the thing. Once they're doing this, once they are like, as I said, every time you take a resource away from a one, you know, direction and you're giving it to another, it's not for free, you know. You need to not only pay for the production of the resource, but of the cost of that other option not existing and not being there, and the other problems that's going to generate. So that additional cost, it's the true cost of them, you know, creating these expanded data centers, that money can use to compensate and to fix the problems that this created. So I think the solution is extremely easy. It's actually just making things worth what they actually are costing the society. Yes? When you're
Calculate,
trying to just say, okay, if they can buy this for 10 cents, why not? But it is costing everybody $10. So how is this, someone is paying, is the rest of us. Yes, by all the issues with the power that we're gonna have, the issues with the environment that we're gonna have, we will pay. So what then, the people that are actually using the resources and taking them away, they should pay the right price.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I think that calculating, but I also think that I don't, I think that there's going to be a lot, I don't think it's going to happen, frankly.
Oh, me neither. I'm just
I
saying,
agree. Like,
I
there is a
have the
true
same one.
cost
It's
associated
true.
with it. Yeah, because like, you look at all the data centers out west, right? In like California where they have droughts, and the water coming out of, I want to say, the Colorado River is overcommitted. And then a lot of that's going to data centers, or to almond growth, right? And that's neither here nor there, but it's the most water intensive crop, I think, in the world, and
Although almond milk is delicious.
it is. Listen, it is. But when you look at the amount of water per square foot that it takes versus like wheat, it's just astronomical. And so, like, it's like, so all of that water going through these data centers can no longer be used to grow
Exactly.
the
And
farm.
that
And that's yeah, it's
means
opportunity cost. Absolutely. No, I completely agree. I think I think that it would be great if we could calculate that. But I also
oh, I can calculate it for you. I have no, I mean, this is the thing. The problem is not actually being able to establish the correct prices. The problem is the will to actually execute what is right. We all
Absolutely.
know that.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Is there any other points you'd like to make, Giselle? Anything else you'd like to bring up? I think we've, I don't know if I have, I'm sure I have a couple more questions I can come up with for you, but I think that this is like really fascinating conversation overall.
Yeah, I mean, anything you want. I actually, for me, I think we've covered a lot of things that are really important is to basically make people understand that AI, as amazing as it is not magical, it's not perfect, and that humans are needed more than ever to actually make these tools work correctly. Yes, and to actually take us to the future that we can have. I mean, there's so many applications where I could like spend hours talking to you how these like algorithms and how these different tools can take us and bring, winnings for everyone, which is what excites me. I like everybody to win. I am of the philosophy, let's not fight for pieces of the pie. Let's make more pies. And this is one of
Agree.
the things that this technology can do. But
Absolutely.
if it is used responsibly, if people understand it, understand what it can do and we cannot do, and actually realize that this is something that will have long-lasting consequences in many different aspects, and we have to take it very seriously. I think that's for me the most important message.
I couldn't agree more. And I don't think we can sign off any better way. Giselle, thank you so much for joining Robots at Red Tape. This has been a pleasure.
Ah, oh, for me too, it was so much fun. I know you're prone to questions, Annick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to Robots at Red Tape. I hope you're having a wonderful day.